York City. New York City. Welcome to our podcast, American Masters, Lennon NYC, Beyond Broadcast. I'm Susan Lacey, the creator and executive producer of American Masters and a producer on Lennon NYC, and with me is our film's director, Michael Epstein.
Hi, Susan.
Wonderful having you here today. Wasn't the other night amazing?
This is our first podcast after our Central Park screening for John's birthday, and I have to say it was an electric night for all of those of you who were there listening in. Thank you for coming out. We had somewhere around, my feeling is probably around 3,000 people inside Summer
Stage. No, I think 4,000.
4,000 in Summer Stage?
The park said 4,000. They could have admitted more, but we had to get started, and they couldn't admit people after the film started.
And I think a couple thousand just sort of ringing the theater, listening in.
Well, Billboard said, didn't they say that 20,000 people showed up?
20,000 people in line. It was a great tribute to John on his birthday, and it was really nice for American Masters, for us at Lennon NYC, to just be a conduit, a vessel for people to be able to celebrate John's birthday. So all of those of you who are joining us on this podcast now because of the screening, welcome. And today we have Gary Van Syack, who is one of the members of Elephant's Memory. Actually, the next 2 weeks we're going to be doing Elephant's Memory. We originally thought that today we would be doing all of Elephant's Memory, Gary and Adam together, and just kind of a little bit. But each interview is about an hour long, and so rather than giving you a crazy long podcast, we decided to break them into two. So today is Gary, and Gary was the bass player for Elephant's Memory and one of its founding members, I think, or maybe he came on just afterwards. Mm-hmm. And Elephant's Memory, as you will find out in the film and in the podcast, was this crazy great rock and roll village street band that was, as Adam says, part of the protest movement. So today, Gary Van Syack.
Thanks, Michael. And join us next week when our podcast will be with another member of Elephant's Memory, Adam Ippolito. And make sure you watch Lennon NYC on the PBS series American Masters, November 22nd. But check your local listings. And to find out more, go to www.pbs.org/AmericanMasters.
A lot of political stuff happening. We had a lot of street bands. The Elephant's Memory is known as a political kind of street band. We had a lot of benefits. Like at NYU, we were raising money for various political activist.
But they're like $2-3 million brownstones, people with their croissants. It's a really Tony Upper East Side kind of.
We all lived there. Yeah, well, everybody lived in the village at the time, except for myself. I was the only Upper East Side guy on 84th and 1st.
But what was it? I mean, was
took
it
a lot of crap for that.
Yeah, very transient, like a lot of students. I mean, you know.
Sort
of.
Oh yeah, we played NYU all the time at the Lube. Was it the Lube Center? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
And every probably two or three times a week, various functions there. There was a lot of NYU activities with a lot of the people that hung out with the band. Jerry Rubin was on the scene. We had a guy, Toby Mamus, I'm sure you are familiar with, who was very active with the band. He was writing for the Village Voice at the time, I think.
So what's in the air? I mean, a sense of a possibility, a sense of defeat, a sense of apathy, that people don't really care about the world that they are in?
No, I don't think that was the case. I think it was the Nixon hate campaign, I think, basically is what it came down to. We have some lyrics in some of our songs of, we're going to have Nixon for dinner tonight. I hope you like him rare.
So, well, give me a sense of Elephant's Memory. How did you guys get together, and what was that band like?
Elephant's Memory was really...
I'm sorry, I was talking about...
Elephant's Memory was really formed in the 60s, like, believe it or not, way back in 65. And one of the first things that happened to Elephant's Memory was they had their house burned down up in Spring Valley, New York. They were away on a gig, and somebody burned their house to the ground. So that was when they decided, we have to live in Greenwich Village. It was just too risky living out in the boondocks. They were doing an album, Take It to the Streets, when I first met them. There it is, the street band. A lot of radical type of lyrics, different songs, that even before we had met and hooked up with John, I'm sure this is the basis of us wanting to be political, was why he joined the band, so to speak. Or we joined his band, which was it?
Exactly. So you had to go to friendly territory.
Exactly. They had done the soundtrack to Midnight Cowboy. We had some success, gold album with the Elephant's Memory soundtrack to Midnight Cowboy. Gold record for that. They had a hit single on the Take It to the Streets album called Mongoose, which was a chart topper. So the band had some significant success even before we met John. Most people don't realize it. They just think John discovered the band, but in fact they had a record career for probably 6-7 years before we met John. Carly Simon was our lead singer for a short time. Am I shocking you on that one?
Yeah.
Carly was in the band for about 6 months, I think. She doesn't appear on any recordings with the band, but as soon as we started playing with John, suddenly she was showing up at the record plant every night. Isn't that funny how that stuff works?
Sound,
very nice lady.
The sound that you guys had was a very unique sound.
Pretty hard rock was the term in those days. Almost bordering on punk, would later become punk in like 76, the new wave as it came in. We sounded more like than one of the new wave bands in 69, I think, than a lot of the new wave bands sounded in 76.
So give me a sense of what that sound was. What comprised the sound? Who were the components of it? And what was the sound?
I can capsulize it in one word: energy. There was just an unbelievable amount of energy emulating from the band. And probably in different types of energy: political energy, musical energy, drugs. I mean, you name it. There was a lot going on.
Stan Bronstein's sax stands out for me for some reason, maybe. A very 50s sounding, I mean, you talk about sort of new wave punk, but I almost hear it as a kind of Sun Records, I mean, like, I don't know, the Stax.
Most definitely. I mean, because Stan was a little older than everyone else. His sources of his inspiration came from, like, Arthur Prysock, the older kind of bop kind of stuff. And as a matter of fact, at Madison Square Garden concert with John, Stan wore a zoot suit. He had tailor-made for him. He was in his glory wearing that zoot suit on stage. That was Stan in a nutshell right there.
So that sense of the village, and somebody had said to me, I think I told you, that Elephant's Memory was a kind of protest band. I mean,
yeah, that's,
sense
that's
of the
a, I'll accept that.
Yeah. What was your relationship, say, to the protest movement? I mean, you weren't just like, go to Ice Cream Social and try to make some bucks. I mean, how did music, or how was music integrated into the anti-war movement? What role did music play?
I think we fueled the energy of everyone in the village on it. I mean, these concerts, the people that came to these benefit concerts were activists, basically. I mean, a lot of them, I remember, were actually they were out of jail temporarily for some bombings and that kind of stuff, some of the people that were around. I won't mention any names, but Jerry Rubin, everybody knows about his activist dealings in the early 70s there. He's the one that was responsible for hooking us up with John, so I had a lot to thank Jerry for.
Give me some sense of Jerry. I mean, Jerry's a complicated guy. He's not with us anymore. But,
right.
He's not, I think because of the fact that he went to Wall Street afterwards, he's sort of not remembered, or he's complicated.
He didn't seem like an activist at all to me. He was just the nicest, mellowest kind of guy. He just didn't, it was just hard to peg, I got along with Jerry tremendously, and I know John and Yoko thought a lot of him. They had him on. He was actually on the Mike Douglas show with us. Played a mean bongo.
That's great. Well, give me some sense of Jerry. Did you talk politics? Was he, when, you know, was he a political guy off stage?
No. That was what was surprising to me. He could come into the dressing room and we could just talk, you know, for an hour, and nothing political would even come up, you know. That was the way I saw Jerry. Now, of course, I know how radical he was, but a lot of that I kind of found out a year or two later, to be honest with you. I didn't really realize at the time. It's funny how you can look back and see
and
things in a different way.
He's also older.
He was, yes,
you know,
yes.
And Abby,
I would guess John's age.
Yeah. And Abby and Allen Ginsberg, were these people also floating?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they'll always be on the scene, always come by to the concert. When I say concert, I mean the Loeb Center at NYU is, what does it hold, maybe 700 people at the most. I mean, these weren't huge concerts, you know, and there was not very much to get in, so... we also did a lot of gigs at Max's Kansas City during that period, so we were kind of back and forth. It'd be a benefit one night, a couple nights at Max's Kansas City. John and Yoko came down to see us at Max's a couple of times. We couldn't get him to sit in, but...
What was that like? I mean, John's not Carly Simon. John's, you know, John's John Lennon. John fucking Lennon.
Yeah.
What's that moment like you realize that John's living on Bank Street?
We heard.
How did you hear that he was in New York?
Through Jerry, actually, was a very much of a close friend of our drummer Rick Frank, who has passed. I heard it at a rehearsal one day that Jerry had been hanging out with John, and they had a couple of meetings. And of course, right away we were thinking, how do we get a tape to this guy? I think Toby Mamus was actually in on a little bit in on that as well. He helped us out. He was writing for The Voice and was on top of everything that the band was doing. And he was one of the ones responsible for getting that tape together that we did on WLIR on Long Island. We did a live performance, and that's the tape that eventually made it to John and Yoko when they were on Bank Street. I even go back further with them than that. They were actually had a little place on Broome Street that before Bank Street. So I think they were still at Broome Street when we first met them in 71. But then just almost immediately, a few weeks later, I remember them getting the place on Broome Street.
On Bank Street.
I'm sorry, yeah, excuse me. Which was right down the street from where we rehearsed at a little studio on Bank called Magna Graphics Recording Studio.
So what was that place like? What was their apartment like?
On Bank Street? A bed? It was very small. It was just a little entranceway, and it was maybe two, three rooms at the most. It was teeny.
But this is New York, so did people come by? Did anybody... care that John was in New York?
I pulled out on 8th Avenue one night after our rehearsal on Magna Graphics, and there was John and Yoko hailing a cab in the middle of 8th Avenue. I went, what the? So I pull over, get in the car, what are you doing, you know? So I don't know where, I forget where they were going, but I took them to where they were going, and it just struck me that was a little... Well, I was, geez, you're a Beatle. You're running around, hailing cabs on 8th Avenue. Aren't you worried about, just people approaching you? And he says, they loved it. They could care less. I think where I left them off was even a more riskier area to be out on your own than where I picked them up. They loved it. They just, anywhere they could go in New York, they just really got off on it.
Why do you think it was? What was it about being able to hail your own cab or sit?
Well, if you'd been barraged by a million, you know, Beatlemania people and thousands of people and not being able to leave your hotel and all that Beatle craziness, I guess it just was a way to kind of meld into the pavement and just be like all the other 8 million New Yorkers for a change and not have to worry about every move you make being recognized. You know, John was... He's the one that got me into hats because he would, every rehearsal he would come to, he'd have a different look, which I totally could relate to now because you wear the same hat a few days, they might start getting wise to who we are.
But he loved the ability to just float through the city in the
Oh, yeah, that was so much a part of what their whole New York thing was about. I mean, they talked about it all the time. We just love it here. There's so much freedom. The art, Yoko is, you know, a tremendous artist, and there were so many things for her to be interested in here. It was just, this was it. All the recording studios, John, there wasn't any place else that I think they would rather have been at that time. They were quite happy being here and looking forward to even more, playing gigs here, and which unfortunately didn't happen in terms of paying gigs, but the Garden eventually came up, and the only way to get around all the green card thing was to do benefit prop concerts, or I guess they somehow there was a loophole we could do the TV shows, and not I guess they didn't get paid, or they just donated the proceeds to the Mike Douglas show or Dick Cavett or whatever it was. So that was they were okay with doing that, but they just couldn't go to a booking agency like ABC booking or, you know.
Before I move on, there's one thing I just have as a note, because I want to make sure I physically do it, because we have photographs and we have, old footage. Give me a physical sense of what the village is like, because, you know, New York's kind of changed so much. I mean, you know, with the Disneyfication of things, and, can you just help me see if I had walked through the village, what would I feel, smell, what would it taste like?
Well, a lot of pizza.
Yeah.
We used to, I used to record a lot at Jimi Hendrix's studio on 8th Street. I think that was even considered as a place where we might record at one time, but somehow we got to the record plant. But in terms of back to what you're asking, as I said, I didn't live in Greenwich Village, and all the other members of the band lived there, but I wish I had of. It was only because I found a cheaper place that I lived on 84th and 1st. I had a five-room apartment instead of a studio for $84 a month, rent-controlled. So that said that all, you know, just couldn't afford to not live up there. But the village was, it sucked you in, because there was so much of that college NYU thing happening at that time in the politics, and you could just walk around for hours in Washington Square Park, and it was just one thing after another. The music, the discussions, even people would be standing on the corner, there'd be a big Nixon discussion all of a sudden would break out, on something that happened in the war maybe that day in the papers. It wasn't just people going to the political functions. It was what everybody was consumed with, it seemed. Because there were a lot less people then, too. I don't think it was quite as crowded. When I go down there now on 8th Street, I'm kind of intimidated by it. It wasn't quite that congested, and it was a lot freer feel to it, than it is now, is what I mean, Michael.
Yeah, no, it must have felt in some ways, I'm jealous of you all, because it must have felt like sort of like you're at the center of the world.
I wish I could have said that.
All right, so give me, so John starts to play with you guys, and he's introduced to you through Jerry. Give me, if you can, that moment when, is he saying, hey, come with me, I've got some songs,
It's kind of an interesting story. As I said, we did this live broadcast on LIR out on Long Island. I don't know whether that station still exists or not, but Billy Joel was actually there too and had played live that day. Just thought of that just now. John heard the tape, and he heard basically what I have heard. He didn't tell me this directly, but what we heard through the grapevine at rehearsals a few days later was he heard all the ingredients of the Plastic Ono Band, but without, Tex Gabriel, Wayne Tex Gabriel, the late Tex Gabriel, I'm sorry to say. Being a tremendously strong guitar player. He had played with Mitch Ryder, his band Detroit. He was from Detroit. And had that big, fat, Les Paul, bendy guitar sound. He was only 21 years old, so he heard that ingredient, I think. It was too hard to get all the pieces of the Plastic Ono Band together. They had done the Toronto Peace Festival, and it was just basically what John told me a little while later was just, it was like pulling teeth to try to get everybody together. He was tiring of that. Nothing personal, I don't think. It was just everyone's schedule.
He needed a new band.
He needed a band. He was dying to play. I mean, he was really hungry to play. So here we are. He heard that big, fat bottom bass sound that I try to produce, which would be a la Klaus Voormann. Bobby Keys was the sax player. He now has Stan Bronstein. Whoa, who's this amazing saxophone player? So he heard all the ingredients that he had captured.
And you guys rock.
But a little harder rocking, I think, maybe, if I can say that and blow my stack a little bit here. He heard the tape and just really loved it. You know, and he heard by where we rehearsed and realized we were a block from his house. Couldn't stand it anymore. He just showed up one night. He wasn't invited. He just came in to Magna Graphics and he said, "I'd really like to meet the band." And the owner of the place, Bob Pruitt, said, "I don't know, man. These guys, they don't like to be interrupted. This is not a band that you just go into the room and say, 'We're here.' You know, these guys are serious. These guys wear buck knives. They wear leather gear. This could be dangerous for you guys." After about an hour of waiting, our road manager comes into Magna Graphics and says, "John Lennon and Yoko are in the waiting room and they really want to come in and talk to you guys." I think we threw about 3 beer bottles across the room, a couple of picks. Come on, man, you have to be kidding us. No Beatle is going to come down to this little crappy studio here, meaning it was small, and to meet us. This is, come on. We left him waiting for another half hour. And finally, he couldn't take it anymore, and they just busted into the room. He came in that white suit. Now, whether it was the white suit he wore on Abbey Road, I don't know, but it looked like it to me. And he came in that white suit, and my jaw just dropped. I mean, everybody, we just could not believe that they would come here to see us. So meanwhile, 8 hours later, after we played all night, we played to our hands were so sore that we were laughing because we couldn't play anymore. He was just so hungry to play. We played every rock and roll, Dizzy Miss Lizzie. We played every rock and roll song known to John. And he just, everything. Hound Dog.
Talk to me about that, if you can. I mean, that idea that John loves this music, right?
Oh, yeah. He was a big Elvis fan. I mean, he mentioned Elvis all the time. But I've never really seen a lot of that written, actually, how big of an Elvis fan he was. Everybody talks about the obvious because he played with Chuck on the show, on Mike Douglas. But I think he was a bigger Elvis fan than Chuck. Or maybe they were tied, whatever.
But give me a sense of John's love for American rock and roll, that 50s American rock and roll.
Well, everybody over there was so influenced by it. I mean, Dizzy Miss Lizzy. I think that's the first song we played. It was great. Roll Over Beethoven, all that stuff that, you know, a lot of Chuck Berry songs. I guess now that I'm thinking about it, that is a lot of Chuck Berry songs, isn't it? But Bo Diddley, he was a big Bo Diddley fan as well. You know, we did a couple of Bo songs that night, and that's when I first realized how much of a strong guitar player he was. When we did the Bo Diddley group, because, you know, Bo Diddley, it's a simple thing, but when you really break it down, it's like a clave, you know, like a it's like a Latin kind of clave kind of thing. And he was so strong on the rhythm guitar, I was going, whoa, this guy can play. I didn't realize, I don't know, you hear all the Beatles albums, a lot of overdubbing going on, but when you hear somebody really wailing live, and they're so strong. We were all so impressed by his guitar playing. It was just, he was like a rock.
And what do you mean he was like a rock? What is that?
Well, it's in his sense of time. You know, you might think that somebody who hadn't played, you know, just kind of in and out, they hadn't really done a lot of touring where you really get what we call our chops strong. I thought maybe he'd laid off maybe a little too long and he might be a little weak or something, you know? not the case. I mean, he was so solid. I mean, he had a sense of time that never wavered, and he had a sense of concentration that once he locked into a part, you can count on that part is not going to deviate or go away for the entire length of the song. I mean, he was...
Yeah, you know, it's an unfortunate... I mean, the Beatles are so good and they're so clean sounding in the studio when you listen to them that for whatever reason, and maybe because their concerts were full of teeny boppers screaming and they couldn't even hear themselves and they were playing in these shitty venues, like, you know, Shea, where, like, nobody could hear anything because they were...
That's true. Well, that's how you...
assume they couldn't play.
Oh, on the contrary, I think, you know, on the musician side, that's when you really, that's what separates the men from the boys, because if you don't have that sense of time and, you know, that rock solidness about you, that's when the band can fall apart, and we call that a train wreck. I don't think they would allow that to happen when they were playing in Germany and stuff. I mean, they were really schooled. They knew that they had to keep it all together, you know. I remember one time that we were actually on the Dick Cavett show and Tex broke a string, the very first couple of notes of, they can actually see it on the DVD, he broke a string, the very first bend of the song Woman is the Nigger of the World. And I was just amazed. It never fazed John for a second. And we talked about it afterwards. I says, John, how'd you do that, man, with that, you know, you broke a string right in your ear, and you just kept right on point. You never missed a word. You never, you know, you just never phased you. And he made a comment to me after. He says, well, you should have been with us in Liverpool, and you should have been with us in Germany, you know. You had to have it together.
Right.
You know, all that experience playing, you know, in all those clubs, those probably dodging beer bottles or whatever. I don't know.
So give me some sense then of sometime in New York City. You're now starting to record with John, I think, at the record plant, right?
Actually, what happened first was the Mike Douglas show. That was the first thing, even before we went into the studio. And that was just a matter of weeks after we had started playing with him. We started rehearsing at Magnographics and started working on Plastic Ono Band tunes initially. We were doing, because John was really still writing Imagine. Even though it's 72 now, Imagine is still on the charts probably at that point. So it was learn Imagine, make it a, polish it up, because we didn't know what was coming up at that point.
But you're going to go out with that album, in other words.
From the very first day, it was, let's put a set together to go out. And we started buying equipment like gangbusters.
So you're then what?
It was a trip to Manny's every day.
You're seeing, so your set is what? I don't want to be a soldier. It's what? Crippled and Son. What are you?
Cold Turkey. Mostly the Plastic Ono Band stuff. And we maybe had done, you know, It's So Hard, Cold Turkey, Imagine. But it wasn't too long. Maybe a week and a half of rehearsing at the most when Woman is the Nigger of the World started, where I heard the first words about there was a new tune. And then I heard something about Sunday, Bloody Sunday. And I went, wow, this is pretty heavy topics.
Very
you know?
Different.
Yeah, I was saying,
did
wow.
Did he talk to you about his ideas for the album? Like his, you know, he talked about it like he wanted to feel like a newspaper headline. Very
yeah, that was the concept right from the
he
beginning. Yeah.
Like, he's not around to tell me.
Well, the way it worked for us is every time he came to rehearsal, there was a new song. And, you know, and we would just simply sit down, discuss. He would go through it, probably on the acoustic guitar first, just let us hear the tune. And we'd probably discuss the lyrics or what we thought the instrumentation might be to the song for that particular song. Most of the time, he had a pretty good idea what it was going to be, whether it was going to be slide guitar or whatever it was going to be. We didn't really start working on any Yoko tunes at that time. But I think We're All Water was probably the first one that that was around at that time.
Sister of Sisters?
Yeah, I don't remember that one being... Yeah, that was kind of like at the end of the sessions. That came a little bit later.
Well, how is he working? I mean, is his song all finished? Is it done when he comes in?
That's a good question. Believe it or not, I think for a while there it was he wrote a song every night, almost. I mean, give or take a day or two for them leaving and suddenly to go fly to Houston to check up on Kyoko, and then they'd be back. And there'd be rehearsal the next day. They might disappear for a week looking for Kyoko. So it was very sporadic in terms of we had a tough time falling into a regular rehearsal, of course.
Did Kyoko weigh on them a lot?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, at that particular point, I think Yoko was very emotional about that whole thing, obviously. I mean, losing a daughter and not knowing where she is, I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, we felt so bad for her, you know. It would be nothing for, there'd be a call, and Yoko would take a call from probably one of her private investigators, probably, or something, I'm guessing there, but... And there would just, that would be it for the day. You know, there was something happening. You know, they had to get flights together. Or sometimes we'd just go to rehearsal thinking he was going to be there and they would be in another part of the world. Just, you know, we'd just hear about it that day, like right at rehearsal for
and
them looking.
And that was really the reason they were in New York, right?
Well, I guess one of the reasons, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Because their lawyer was here, I think, on that. Yeah.
Right.
And of course, the green card issue was another thing that was.
I'm going to get to that after the album.
We'll hold off.
I want to go to the album.
Yes.
Yeah, so he comes into the. He's written something that night before. How does he work? Does he?
It was the time then. I think we were at the record plant already, so it was 7 to 7 every night. There would be a new song show up at 7 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, there would be a finished, mastered. Mixed song for the album. So the first couple of minutes are him running the tune down on the acoustic guitar, making suggestions to everybody about not specific things to play, but again, about instrumentation that he might like. I'd like, you know, Tex, I'd like you to play dobro on this or slide guitar on this, or I need a really strong blues solo on this. And then, of course, on as I was telling you earlier, the song that I played with Jim and John Sinclair is the song with just Jim and John was the biggest thrill for me. But I'm getting off the track here.
No, it's interesting, though, because, you know, the way that you look at, like, say, Abbey Road or Sgt. Pepper's or even later John albums, you know, these are albums where every tune is, like, massaged and every measure is, like, considered.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would take hours and days and weeks sometimes. And
right.
So
totally
I
different
can't
format.
Imagine that this album is, I mean, there's a bootleg that I've heard of John about to click into New York City. And I'm going to talk over this, Roger, and you just let me know when New York City's not helping us with its added sound effects. And John's, you know, going in and he goes, you know, all right, I'm all ready to go. It sounds good. But I know what you're going to do. You're going to make it this clean, clean fucking sound that I hate. He wanted it raw. But, you know, my sense is that John wanted this album, like, almost unfinished.
Okay, right.
Right?
Oh, yeah, it was very basic. Very basic. I mean, it was bing, bang, boom. I mean... There might be an hour on the drum sound. As I said, you run it down first, an hour on the drum sound, or an hour and a half maybe, because that was really important for the recording itself. But a lot of those songs were at least second take. There might even be a couple of first takes in there. I mean, it was very, almost live.
And that's unusual.
And the band Elephant's Memory, I think, added a lot to that, because everything we did was live.
But that's unusual.
We had that live sound, you know, that's part of what we were.
It contributes, I think, about the sound as it relates to the way the album, I mean, you know, we don't have albums now, but I bought recently the album and I held it and I looked at it and considered it and opened it. And,
there you go.
You know, I have a record player, I played it, and it was, you know, something I hadn't done in a while. And,
mm-hmm.
But I think about the cover with the newspaper and the headlines. And then I think about the sound. There was all of that, like, day up. Like, we got to get it onto the presses.
That's
Can you talk
good.
To me at all about how the sense of, like, you know, it's coming in off the wires. Let's write the story and get it out in that day's paper. There's a is that a fair assessment?
Oh, that's right on the money. Yeah,
exactly. I'm not going to force to be able to interview.
I understand. Yeah. Well, as I said, it was like a different topic every night, a different political topic, and a different political venue in terms of or a musical venue to put a musical style to put it into. I mean, we had John Sinclair, which was a bluesy slide guitar. He was playing dobro on that. And then we had the Sunday Bloody Sunday night, which was interrupted by Jackie Kennedy and Rudolf Nureyev's little visit in the middle of the recording studio. You never knew who was going to show up. So it was kind of a chaos thing in terms of just the session itself almost being, you know what I mean, not the furthest away you could get from like a Beatles session, you know, where it was probably closed, and as you said, every little sound was meticulously, it was like, get a sound and let's go with it, you know. I mean, Roy Sakala was just so tremendous, the engineer. I mean, he was just...
And it creates this kind of like Sunday paper kind of, right?
I think, New York Times, kind of that was perfect for the album, I thought.
How is the album... the last question I have is John talking politics or just music as well? He's playing a song, this is about the Irish protest, this is about Angela Davis, this is about whatever it is. Is it just a music conversation you're having?
For me, yes. Okay. Yeah. But I overheard a lot of other, you know, discussions in the control room. You know, I'm stuck outside in a cubicle, you know, with the drummer. But, I heard there were a couple of times where we stopped and, you know, would talk about the lyric because it was really about what might happen on the guitar or the keyboards, you know, a musical connection to the lyrics, in other words. That would be the only time I ever heard anything like that going on when there was a musical context.
You know, the other thing about the album is that it's Plastic Ono Band, An Elephant's Memory. It's John and Yoko and you guys. I mean, it's Yoko, too. I mean, she's a big...
Right. For that album, yeah.
She's a big part of that album.
Definitely.
I mean, she's an author of that album.
She was the inspiration for Woman is the Nigger of the World.
Was there a sense when you were recording that song, you were like looking at each other going, what the fuck is he thinking? Dick Cavett, you know, he sat here and he was like, I had a lot of trouble with ABC.
Oh, yeah, that was a big row, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys, while you were recording it, thinking, like, this is not going to be good?
Yeah, no, not at all. I didn't realize it until they came out. They had to put that thing in the New York Times, the full page, back page of the New York Times, you know, with the definition for nigger. And then I realized, ooh, I guess this is not going to go well in terms of they're going to really get on his case about some of this stuff. I didn't see that coming.
Because you understood what he was saying?
Yeah, I understood what he was saying, but I guess I was kind of naive, in terms of how the media might look at all that stuff. You know,
right.
It was 1972. It's easy to think about it now, but in 1972, Nixon was still president.
Yeah.
They were still tapping my phone in my basement on 84th Street.
All right, we'll get there. So I want to give Yoko her due, too, because we talked about John in the studio. We'll talk about Yoko in the studio, too, because, you know, I think she unfortunately gets short shrift as John's partner and sort of as, you know, people quite demeaningly dismiss her. But
yeah, it's too bad because she was really very musical. Came in as prepared as John. When it was her tune, she prepared the chords. She was the one that told my sidekick Adam Ippolito about the key, and she played pretty good little piano too. So she would be the conveyor of the song, as opposed to John coming in and giving the song. It would be Yoko presenting the song. She wrote the song. She was going to present it to us. So she might sit in the studio with us for an hour and make sure it was up to snuff. And we would always have a little bit of editing ourselves. We helped too. When the arrangement wasn't working, we knew first. And we would make suggestions. And they're always quite open to any changes that we made.
How are their working styles different? I mean, how is Yoko... Yoko comes from a different place than John. John comes from American 50s rock. rock and roll, right. Chuck Berry, Elvis. Yoko comes from a more avant-garde.
Classical. She had a classical background. I think she had studied classical pianos. That's what it sounded like to me. She had a very formal kind of style.
How was her approach different than John's?
Musically?
Yeah, musically, working with you guys in terms of what her ear is.
She just knew what she liked. She didn't make a lot of suggestions. She, you know, John would make, you know, play this chord, arpeggiate that, you know, bend this, too much of a line there. Yoko never made any comments like that, but if it wasn't happening, you would still know it, because she would come out and say, can we just change this part? It wouldn't be a specific suggestion, but she would leave it up to us to just come up with something a little different until we made her happy. Very tactful. She was very good. I enjoyed working with her.
And she knew her way around the studio, this note?
Technically? No, I don't think so.
Right.
I think that was pretty much left up to Roy and John.
Right.
John was pretty much the dial turner. And she would convey it to John, and he would be the middleman between Yoko and Roy Sakala.
Okay, so Sometime in New York City comes out, and it is not a number one hit, is it?
No, it's not.
Talk to me about its reception. As painful as it is.
Well, I can't say we were disappointed, because we were busy buying gear and going out doing our own gigs on the weekends, so I didn't really have time to think about, you know, that it was such a flop. But I realized that the political issue was something that probably would hold the album back, you know, in terms of sales, because I just don't think people were ready for it. Not everyone is political-minded like we all were in New York at the time. And so out in the Midwest, I can see where that might have went over everybody's heads.
Well, Rolling Stone was brutal. I mean, Rolling Stone,
yeah, I don't recall that.
Career suicide was there.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess that does sound a little familiar now that I'm thinking about it. I haven't thought about it in a long time. I knew that wasn't true. If you can write all those songs in a week, I mean, there must be a lot of other great songs in there.
Was John disappointed, you think?
I think he was. Yeah, I think he was. He wasn't disappointed in us, but I think he was disappointed in the reaction. I didn't think he would be. It would be that much of a disappointment for him, but I think it was. Yeah. Everybody has an ego, I guess. It never hurts if you're an artist to not have something go well, when you think about how successful everything he did before that was, and then to finally be confronted with something that isn't a huge, and had to affect you.
Had to hurt. Now, Nixon is finishing up his first term, and John has sort of, I'm trying to figure out what's the truth here, but there's sort of nebulous plans with Jerry, and Jerry's mind and John's mind, there isn't. But in the FBI's mind, undeniably is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, whatever John and Yoko thought about whether they were going to go to the convention, whatever Jerry thought about whether they were going to go to the convention, the FBI absolutely, undeniably believes that John is going to go.
Very true.
And foment revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the time you guys are recording the album, he's got deportation hanging over his head, and he's got... what he starts to talk about is the FBI following
right.
him.
Exactly.
Talk to me about the deportation order, if you can, for a second. Did they ever communicate, like, what the fuck is going on?
Oh, yeah, every night. There would be an update every night. If they would come to rehearsal, there'd be an update about what, of course, we wanted to know. I mean, hey, when are we going out? We've got the gear now, or we're starting to assemble the gear. We're ordering custom-made road cases. It's time to go out and tour. You know, let's get some bookings. Let's do it. And even then, I don't think he realized that he couldn't do it. You know what I mean? It was just, we have to put it off because I want to tend to this deportation thing and get everything straight before we go out, which never happened, didn't happen for 4 more years.
But his sense with the deportation thing was a small inconvenience?
Not a small one, but I think he thought it was going to be rectified very soon. And we kept hanging on that and hanging on it to one week to the next. And it's just something that never happened.
Was he scared?
No, I don't think he was scared.
Worried,
yes.
Let me put it better.
Yeah.
Was he worried?
I think he was worried, yeah. He was concerned about it. I mean, it was important. I mean, he wanted to go play. He enjoyed New York, and he wanted to stay here. They were settled in. We've got a band. I'm writing songs. Everything's going well, but I can't go out and play. This is not good.
And why couldn't he play?
He didn't have a work visa. You can't make money in the United States to get paid and go on the books. You don't have any Social Security account. You don't have anything. It's just, he was dead in the water at that point. The only visa he had was to be able to be here for a short time more.
Right, and keep having to get extensions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. He just kept hanging on from one extension to the next.
And Kyoko was still
out there.
And that must have been a problem, too.
Through that whole year, yeah. So the whole time I was with John and Yoko, that was the case.
All right, so give me some sense, then, of is the notion that the FBI gave a shit about John or anybody at that moment just full of shit? I mean, is it just paranoia?
I don't think so. I mean, I saw the guy, on my phone, those FBI guys were in the basement of my building for the whole time we were recording. I would see them. They knew I knew they were there. I would come in. I would ring my buzzer, and they were in around the stairs in the back, and they had their little tape machine set up, and I could hear the click on my phone every time I picked it up, so it wasn't hard to figure out. Pretty unnerving, actually, at the time. More so for my wife. I think she, at the time, she was very paranoid about that. Who wouldn't be?
Almost as if they wanted you to know.
Yeah, exactly. They were not hiding it. In my case, at least.
Give me a sense, if you can, of just your own personal take on Nixon getting reelected.
I was shocked. I was surprised. I didn't believe it happened.
What happened?
That he got reelected. Our thing was, I thought maybe we'd have some impact, the whole thing. But of course, it was just not to be done,
Just the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a landslide.
Yeah, I know.
Were you guys
just shocked?
Land?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, when you're doing a political song every night and you're doing political rallies and you actually think, we're going to make a difference and hello, not good.
How was John that night?
Disappointed. That's the only way I can put it. He didn't really say a lot, but we could just tell everybody was down about it,
Were you at Jerry's party afterwards? Did you count that again?
For a short time.
Talk to me about it. I mean, I've heard that, and from Yoko, so it's not like there's any
I understand.
Secret, that he had too much to drink and that he was belligerent. Can you talk to me about, the little bit that you saw and why you left early? What was going on?
That was John. There was a point where when he was drinking, that he got to a point where it just wasn't good, an English thing, I don't know. I don't know, I really don't. I can't, it's unfortunate, because I saw that a little bit at Home Restaurant on a couple occasions, but not too much. I didn't really think it was that bad, but that night, apparently it was. I had left a little early, so I really can't comment. It would all be secondhand on anything after I split that night.
But before you split?
Rowdy. We were very rowdy. Way too rowdy. My wife had too much to drink. I just wanted to leave. I'm not one of those get drunk, fall down kind of guys. I just reach my limit and that's it, So it was time to bail for me. Can't really comment on anything after that.
No, that's fine. John came in angry, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he just off the wall, just in a seemingly a bad mood that I had never really witnessed before. I don't know what. Right. Maybe there was something that went down before that. I don't know.
Right. No. I think it was just.
I'm just trying to be honest.
Yeah,
I just can't.
Everything was too much. Give me a sense of the concert, the one-to-one concert. That album, you're out there. What are you doing? That concert is a precursor, right?
I think he thought of the one-to-one concert as a rehearsal for the world tour because he didn't take it all that seriously. I mean, he was okay with some mistakes. Let's work it out. Was that right on stage? Now let's try that four times at the end next time. John, we're on stage at the Garden. Is this a rehearsal? We rehearsed 2 weeks at the Fillmore East for every day. John was a slave driver, I want to tell you. Two sessions a day on the set for the one-to-one. And he liked to have a tight band, so the rehearsals were intense.
And the song selection was all the New York City album? What was it?
It was New York City. Cold Turkey, It's So Hard, Imagine, so it was a little bit of the Plastic Ono Band album, the Imagine album, excuse me, the Plastic Ono Band. And we talked John into doing one Beatles song. We coaxed and coaxed and coaxed. John, come on, we gotta do one Beatles song. And he just wasn't into it. I wanna make sure that everybody realizes, you know, this is me, I'm on my own now, you know. But after 2 weeks of rehearsing and coaxing him, he finally relented and we did Come Together. And a great version of Come Together.
What do you remember that? And Yoko did any numbers too?
No? We're All Water, I think she does. Sisters, Oh Sisters, you know, from the Sometime in New York City album. Yes, yes.
So how did the concert go over? How did you guys go over? How did we receive?
Tremendous. I mean, the crowds were just unbelievable. I think it was, they filled the floor at the Garden, so it was 25,000 people in the afternoon, 25,000 in the evening. The clincher was that they handed out 25,000 tambourines in the afternoon. So have you ever heard 25,000 people trying to get on the beat with tambourines? It was pretty unnerving. So I think that's why it goes down in history as I've been told that it was the loudest concert ever at the Garden, because when we chose equipment, as I said, Elephant's Memory had a knack for finding the loudest amps on the market, so everything was on 11. And I've heard people say that they had to move and were physically sick in the first 10 rows from how loud it was. Personal friends that I know that were there had to move back 50 rows.
That's fantastic.
We're using the Rolling Stones light show at the Mick was nice enough. Mick, who also showed up on a lot of the sessions, by the way, very close with John. Great guy. You could just tell how close they were. I was kind of surprised to see how well they got on. They were very, very close.
Yeah.
So he loaned us the, they had just finished that tour. Excuse me?
Well, when you guys finished one-to-one and it's pretty clear that the deportation stuff's not going to go away,
yeah.
Some point Yoko sends John to Los Angeles and you all move on. Did you stay in touch?
The Parting of the Ways letter, yes. Yeah. We got a nice little letter in the mail. Of course, he told us and talked about us to us about it before we got the official letter from, we call it the Parting of the Ways letter. Basically, it was the letter was just to let us know that I don't know what to tell you. It has nothing to do with you guys. Apple will probably come for the equipment. It'd be my guess, he said, but don't worry about it. I'm not worried about it. It just didn't work out. I can't help, you know, the deportation thing just isn't going to fly. Now I've got this problem with, you know, I'm with Yoko, and we're splitting up, and so it was a great letter. It was very cordial, and I appreciated him sending it.
But it's over.
Done.
Did you ever hear about his L.A. sojourn, or about like what was going on? Because he kind of almost lost it in L.A.
Pretty close, I hear. Only what you have probably heard, and what has been documented in the papers, is all. No, I did not. No, I didn't have any dealings with John. I didn't hear from John again or talk with John until before a little bit before Double Fantasy, after the, you know, the layoff of
having. Did you hear from him?
I sent him a tape of some original songs that I had written. I was hoping to contact him, of course, and since I heard he was back in town. He was very nice. I sent him the tape. He listened to it.
So I'm curious what, if you thought about or remember, John's coming back. He's got this album. So happy. And then this sort of weird, kind of surreal, almost unbelievable news that he's shot on his way home, walking into the Dakota.
Well, that night was, from my perspective, if you can believe this, I was on the scene when it happened. A strange occurrence. I mean, something I have taken years to deal with, to figure out, first of all, what are the odds of playing with a Beatle as the bass player? And secondly, to be on the scene when he was shot.
Tell me what happened.
I was, to make a long story short, I had an 11 o'clock, we were going to see an 11 o'clock jazz set at Paulson's, a jazz club right across the street from the Dakota. So we were coming out of the cross street from the park, looking for a place to park. And I saw a police car with the siren on pulling away from the Dakota. And I turned to my friend and said, I just got a vibe. I said, boy, I hope nothing's happened to John. Pulled into a parking place in front of Paulson's, and as we had just cleared the door, and two waitresses come running out of the place screaming, John Lennon's been shot. So my friend and I just sat down at a table, and it took about 15 minutes to just let that sink in. And by that time, we could see out on the street that the people starting to congregate. They were coming from everywhere. So we walked out of the club. Of course, we weren't going to stick around for any music. There was no music that night. And I bet by the time we got back to the car, there were at least 300 or 400 people on the street already. I mean, it was just, the word spread like, I've never seen anything like it. It was just unbelievable.
What were they doing?
Crying, screaming, angry. Look, you know, where's the person that did it? How could this happen? For me, it was just the fact of being there was just, I just couldn't understand why, you know, why am I here on the scene, you know, to be drawn somehow to that, the scene like that? Exactly. I'm feeling like, well, there's one of the best musicians, best songwriters, best friend I've, you know, helped leave with our career, our producer, our, my mentor, you know, because I looked up to John. He was older than me.
But you're not, you're talking about everything about what you're feeling.
Yeah. this is the worst thing that I think has ever happened to me. I mean, I was destroyed. It took me at least a year to just get over the fact that, first, that there's not going to be any John to call, and I'm not going to be able to give him any of my tunes. We had kind of co-written a song on my Elephant's Memory album. I was hoping to get together with him again because now he's active again. There's a chance. I can stop by the Dakota, you know, and we can start hanging out again. Or what, you know, it's on. It's just like having the whole thing ripped out. All of us. It's like the bottom coming out of our lives. You know,
it was
all the time. Cried all the way home. I wouldn't even have been able to drive if my friend hadn't been driving. I don't know how I would have. I probably had to take a cab home. It was just, you wanted to get out of there because it was really started to be crazy. I'm sure you've heard and seen the reports. I mean, there were thousands of people, that, you know, within probably an hour. The word just, New York City, boy, it spreads like, didn't take long for the bad news to get around. So I just rushed back to my home and on the east side. And watched the rest of it on TV, as we all did that night, and just
in shock.
And all my friends calling up, and you know, people want to confirm it, and I'm trying to explain to it why I just came from there. Why were you there? I don't know why I was there.
So how long did it take for it to sort of sink in?
Oh, it was immediate for me. It never left. You know, I guess maybe for a couple of years later it started to get... one of the reasons that I was able to grieve is we put together a project with Randy Clark, who had done John and Beatlemania at the time. And Randy and I took a show out. I put together a band called Imagine. And we did a tribute to John, and it ran here on the East Coast for about 6 months. We played all the major clubs and venues on the East Coast. And that was our way of grieving, my way of grieving. It was to just throw myself into that project and playing all John's songs. And I was very proud of the project. Again, that was Randy Clark from Beatlemania who played John on Beatlemania.
So that's a nice... if I've got enough time, I want to end on a more thoughtful, positive place. What do you think his legacy is? I mean, is it the kind of peaceful tune like an Imagine or Give Peace a Chance or War is Over? Is it something more pressing and immediate like Mother or Your Blues or Cold Turkey? What is the sort of legacy that we are left
with? Well, I think it's multifaceted. I think the Mother and the Imagine stuff, they're all great, but it's about that world view to me, you know, how he spoke for the whole world, you know. I mean, that's probably been said a million times, but in terms of Cold Turkey and those Mother, the personal ones, I think it, to me, I think my songwriting is a lot more personal. Now I'm not afraid to go to maybe some topics in my songwriting after that I maybe wouldn't have touched on because I was inspired by his personal approach. But my most respected songs my most respect for John is his songwriting, and the songs like with Imagine and Give Peace a Chance and his sense of having peace in the world. That was it.
You get the sense that there are a lot of rock and rollers, but there's really only one John Lennon. I mean, there's like...
That's so true. Amen.
You know, a lot of very big names come.
It's true.
A lot of your generation, really sort of Julian's. And it's,
I understand.
He's still the same for me that he was for, it's like weird. He has a certain magnetism.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It never has left. Even in the wake of his death. I mean, it's just.
Well, is it irony for you that he died so violently in New York in the city he loved?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, when I saw him hailing cabs on 8th Avenue, I'm saying, ooh, I don't know. I mean, I know you love it here and everything, but be careful. I used to tell them all the time, hey, it's 7 o'clock in the morning here, I mean, it's just got daylight here. I mean,
But he loved New York.
Didn't faze him the least. He just didn't want to hear about it. He just loved the hang, that freedom of being here and being able to do anything they wanted to do and not think about who was hanging around or being recognized, at every turn.
He could be John Lennon.
Exactly.
And just not Beatle John Lennon.
Right. Yeah, I wish I would have put it like that.